every age, there is a context in which we ask the faith questions. That doesn't mean that the gospel changes. It does mean that there are different contexts in different ages. I didn't think it would often be the case that I would tell you that Time magazine had accurately portrayed the context for the mission questions, but I think they're getting closer. I'm going to read from the June 4th, 1979 Time magazine. Toward dusk, their small boats go whumping across lakes and bays, rooster tailing on fierce twin 100 outboards. Caravans of 8 miles to the gallon RVs start homing off the interstates, their occupants damply chilled in the air conditioning, bathed in Dolly Parton from the tape deck. And in shopping malls, supermarkets the size of National Guard armories feel as cold as meat lockers. And housewives in pedal pushers go brrr as they load their carts with food encased in a wealth of non-returnable glass, metal, and paper. They shake their heads as they pay what the checkout computer demands of them and pile the groceries into broad-beam station wagons. At home, the automatic ice maker sighs and clatters in the kitchen, the automatic washer discos through the spin cycle, and the microwave starts the dinner. Meantime, in winding ropes of bright capillaries, the slow and overpowered commuting cars poof home. From above at night, American cities look like garishly jumbled jewelry strewn up and down the landscape. In the centers, empty high-rises of piled diamonds glow, great sparklers kept alight for the cleaning women and for the admiration of passing planes. For years, foreigners have regarded America enviously and contemptuously as a shocking wastrel, bespotted with its own resources, lighting cigars with $1,000 bills. In winter, visitors remark, the U.S. is always too warm indoors, in summer, always too cold. In a flawless little American parable, Richard Nixon used to turn up the White House air conditioning full blast and then start a cozy blaze in the fireplace. Since the early 70s, Americans have been flirting reluctantly with a complicated and grudging awareness about themselves and their orgies of fossil burning, but they are still in the quibbling stage, in what psychologists call a period of defensive avoidance. Now, part of the heart of this article. The real calculus of American strength is not expressed primarily in terms of a willingness to fight or in numbers of missiles and warheads. It is not expressed in how tough Americans can be with the Soviets or anyone else. It is expressed precisely in how tough Americans are willing to be with themselves. A damaging slackness, a widespread feckleness have grown evident not only in American leadership and in its corporations, but in the U.S. society at large. Several generations of us have been spoiled crazy. Having the highest standard of living in the world has made us vulnerable. In times of crisis, reactions are almost childlike. People want their candy, and the need to modify lives will evoke anger. The tradition of material salvation is the profoundest question confronting Americans. The logic of the energy shortage dictates cut down because supplies are finite. The questions raised about nuclear power industry by Three Mile Island accident only reinforce the logic. Yet Americans have not sifted through the questions of their priorities. They want energy without risk. They may be a long time in settling the question of what price they are willing to pay for their power. Americans historically have believed that they can have it both ways, indeed every way. Their success was erected upon a profligate exuberance. The problem is that too many Americans are accustomed to acting only in emergencies, and too few of them are persuaded that they actually face one at the moment. I think that's still true. If you like Dickens, we're like Mr. Micawber. Something will turn up. Presumably, they will, and I don't know why he keeps saying they. I think he's one of us. I'd rather say we. Presumably, we will wake up to the certain knowledge of it before too long. As Samuel Johnson said, when a man knows he's to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. My assumption is that within the things characterized by that Time magazine, it's almost an editorial, and by the way, it's called The Weakness That Starts at Home. That within the things raised by that writer, you have some of the context for how we ask the mission questions today. That more and more is becoming part of our awareness that we live in that kind of world and that we face those kinds of crises. He says we still do not live in a country that sees that we have those problems clearly, but I think there's been a great shift. Mary and I led retreats on those issues 4 years ago, and we had very, very few people who thought we were on anything that was significant for America. They thought maybe the Quakers were worried about things like that or doing something, but not Lutherans. Lifestyle changes were relegated to hippie kids building geodesic domes, not Lutheran people who were so eager to prove we didn't just get off the boat. I mean, we have not had a great desire to be counterculture. We've changed schmierkäse to cottage cheese so we didn't look like krauts who just came over or some such thing, or the Norwegian accident was an embarrassment everywhere but Holden. So if we call into question that part of the American dream which has that kind of waste, we have not wanted to be counterculture. For the biblical study this morning, instead of taking a particular passage, I'd like to have as the premise that there is an assumption biblically, that behind the biblical writings, one of the assumptions is an idea of sufficiency as a lifestyle. That part of the problem in America is not our way of grabbing things, but our way of looking at things. And that's clearly the role of the church, is to help people understand that faith is a way of seeing. And that's the real revolution. When there's a new way of seeing, that's the revolution. That's what the work of the Spirit is. That's the word metanoia. The word repentance is you were walking one way and you get turned around, and therefore things that used to be forward are now backward, and you literally see differently. St. Francis of Assisi wanted to be known as a tumbler for God. I think he would have been comfortable with a lot of Rich Kemmerer's comments about clowns and other things, because he meant partly a vagrant tumbler or a circus performer, but he also meant see differently. He said, I want to see the world as a tumbler for Jesus. And he said, when you're standing on your head, when the rest of the people are saying, isn't it marvelous this city we've built? I say, isn't it marvelous that God hasn't dropped us yet? Can you feel the difference in that? There are some biblical assumptions. And to be a follower of the way is to have my vision change. I am disillusioned. So when someone says, in the modern world, does the Bible make sense? I say, in the biblical viewpoint, does the modern world make sense? I don't apologize for that at all. I think that's what it means, to have had my life shifted. All right. I think one of the assumptions behind Scripture is an idea of enough is enough, and I'm using sufficiency for that. If you want to turn to Proverbs 30, 8 and 9, this is one of the places that it said, and I'm using this as kind of the text for the day, and then just lots of other places where I think you pick up the thread. Somebody want to read? If you've got this one, at 7:30 we've gotten the communal habit of saying what page it's on so that nobody gets embarrassed because they don't have to look in the index then if they can't find it. It's 571 if you have one of the Holden RSV. Somebody want to read Proverbs 38 and 9 for us? It's going to be a long morning. Do I have to call on somebody? Just start reading, someone.
Remove far from me falsehood and lying. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny thee, and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God.
All right, obviously I'm talking about the last part of 8 and 9. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me. That kind of phrase is what we're going to pick up in lots of places from Scripture. The idea of sufficiency or enough. And the writer of Proverbs even goes on to say the pitfalls of either too much money, then I don't think I need God at all, or poverty where, and that is not what we're talking about today, voluntary poverty or asceticism. I don't think you find that scripturally. I think you find a very wholesome stewardship, not denying that God is the giver of every good and perfect gift. Poverty leads to despair, and riches lead to pride, and so the proverb and almost the prayer of the Scripture is, give me enough, so that I'm thankful to the giver, so that I have a life that is sufficient. I'm saying that that part of that which ought to happen, if Time magazine has characterized our age, is that we who do understand a scriptural point of view and have Christ as our Lord, begin to live an attitude of enough and to have as a witness to a world where the restaurant in Denver, I used to have a whole sheaf of things. The restaurant in Denver had a half-page ad. The one place in town where enough is never enough. Los Angeles, I read in the Los Angeles paper when I was there, if there would be one word, this was a writer who was bragging about Los Angeles, if there's one word to characterize our city, it's more, more, more. Said it three times and got it in boldface at the end. In the midst of that, can you understand that part of the Christian witness might be to say no to that and to say enough is enough and to find the freedom in enough? If we do not figure out for us what's enough, we will never be full, satisfied, contented. The opposite of enough is insatiable appetites. And I think we've been given the idea that the appetite ought to be insatiable. And Scripture has a very different point of view. Let's check it at some other places. Jeremiah 22:13 talks about, and there is a strong word in the Hebrew. I guess greed is as close as we come to it, but it really doesn't say it the way the Hebrew. But Jeremiah 22:13 will give you a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about.
670.
And it may go beyond 13, but let's try that one. You want to read it? Who said the page? You get to read it, Hans.
Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness and his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbor serve him for nothing and does not give him his wages.
Keep going.
Who says, I will build myself a great house with spacious upper rooms and cut out windows for it, paneling it with cedar and painting it with vermilion.
Go on, yeah.
Do you think you are a king because you compete in cedar? Did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? Then it was well with him.
One more.
He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well. Is not this to know me, says the Lord?
Okay. Almost. Does the fact that your house is made of fancy wood and has expensive paint, do you think that makes you a king? The assumption that we are what we have, or that our status comes from how much we have, is so ingrained that I think once in a while we have to get back to a scriptural understanding. In the 4 years that we traveled and tried to bring this kind of thing throughout the church, most of the time the audiences for our retreats and for the lectures I gave were middle-class people. That's what I am, that's what most Lutherans are. Most of the people, including us in this room, have the luxury of choosing whether or not we want to simplify a lifestyle. Is that not true? I mean, you can leave Holden and say, I liked some of the things they said, I didn't like others, I'll do this, I won't do that. That's a luxury. Most people in the world today live simply because they have no other option. Once in a while, one of those kind came to one of the sessions we did, and I was always somewhat uncomfortable, because much of what we're doing today, instead of coming from a biblical faith, is the latest fad. Blue jeans instead of polyester, and soybeans instead of red beef, and aren't we groovy? Coevolution Quarterly, which is Mother Earth News Quarterly, said the Simple Life movement in the United States is just a fad, and they pictured it by the local Porsche dealer changing his name to Briar Patch Porsche and putting a sign in every windshield that said, Live Simply. You know, Mother Earth News just said, there is no radical lifestyle change. We're just in a new middle class phase. All right. When one of the people who didn't have a choice came, I was always somewhat uncomfortable. Black welfare mother sat with us from Friday night till Sunday noon and didn't say much. And at the Eucharist on Sunday morning, we had shared words. If the community knows one another and it's small enough, I don't think the preacher ought to be the only one who brings a word. So they were kind of, this is what the retreat meant to me, this is what I'd like to share, this is the text that's strong for me. She said, I want to tell you what the weekend was like, and I didn't know what was coming. She said, just before I came on this, almost, I had done it again. I had almost bought a new kitchen dinette set on time payments. She said, I may be poor, but I ain't stupid. I know what the interest rate would have been, 20%. That's true for inner city people who don't have good credit and want to buy on time. She said, the reason I had almost bought a new dinette set was because I had been convinced that I was not a decent mother and a decent human being because my furniture was shabby. And I wanted to be a decent mother. So I had almost bought new furniture. The weekend said, you don't need that dinette set to be a good mother and a decent human being. And I hugged her. I'll go anywhere with the gospel. Isn't the epitome of the gospel that our worth is not dependent upon the kind of furniture in our kitchen? This passage says, do you think that's what makes you a king, that kind of stuff? And it obviously, sarcastically says that, right? Our worth is based on something else. And when it comes to that which is necessary for our life, can you begin to say enough is enough? Proverbs has some places, we won't look all these up. Proverbs has some places that talk about never being satisfied. If you're the kind that likes to make notes, just make a note of Proverbs 13, 15, and 16, but I'll read it to you. The leech has two daughters. Give, says the one. Give, says the other. Three things there are which will never be satisfied. Four which never say enough. The grave, a barren womb, a land thirsty for water, and fire that never says enough. Insatiable appetites. Betza, Hans? Is that the Hebrew word for that insatiable appetite? I'm not a good enough Hebrew scholar. But voracious greed. If you add the word voracious, maybe you'll be at it, which is spoken of so often in the Old Testament as that which consumes us and takes away our freedom, becomes our slavery. Let's shift it and do it another way. How do you find, or where do you find, this attitude of sufficiency? Let's just think without looking back at certain sections of starting at the beginning of the scriptures. In the creation, the seventh day, the Sabbath, a day off, enough is enough. 6 days you work, then you take a break. Abraham Heschel, the Jewish leader and scholar that died not too long ago, says that the clearest grace in the Old Testament is in the Sabbath. And his little book on Sabbath used to, I think we still have it in the bookstore, that it really says the world will not end if you take a day off. That's a refreshing understanding of this business that enough is enough. By the way, when you read in Exodus 23, we usually take our Ten Commandments from Exodus 20, don't we? When you have catechism. Exodus 23, it's clear that one of the reasons for the Sabbath is that the oxen also get a break. I kind of like that dimension because we don't have that understanding of shalom, the interconnectedness between us and all creation. But it's a day off for everybody. Or some of the laws in the Old Testament. One of the laws in Deuteronomy is never beat the olive branch twice. What in the world does that say?
Leave something for someone else to glean.
Leave something in your harvesting. Some birds may be coming. That's part of the environmental. Some poor people may count on that olive. Mary and I have done farming for the last 6 years in West Virginia, so I've read farming journals. I never read anything. And you read the John Deere ad about the corn picker, and it'll guarantee that it'll pick up one ear if it falls in the neighbor's 40. That it. The whole understanding of gleaning is very much like that never beat the olive branch twice, is it not? An understanding of take what's enough, but be a little careless because there's some poor coming along. If you take the mother bird, you do not take the baby bird. That's also a law in the Old Testament. What does that say? The what?
You'll starve the baby to death.
Yes. Well, let's say the baby is weaned, all right? All right, you don't hunt to extinction. We've hunted to extinction. I don't know the endangered species list. I know two strands of whales, because Time magazine just showed that boat that goes out and all that conflict over the whales. That's a real controversial political issue in some places. But we hunted to extinction two species of whales, and we didn't even eat the meat. It went for corset stays, perfume, and pet food. That's not, I'll be very mild, that's not a biblical vision of shalom. I'll just say it that way. It's early in the morning, and I'm not angry at anybody, so I'll be very, I'll make the understatement of the year. That's not a biblical concept of shalom. Maybe one of the places in the Old Testament where you see it is the manna, Exodus 16:18. Does the word paradim mean anything to you? I asked Jan Hansen the other day what it meant to him. If there is a paradim or a model for enough is enough, the manna story, I think, would be one of the places where you find that. Exodus 16, well, we could start with 13. Somebody want to read that? But go through 18.
In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every man of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer apiece, according to the number of the persons whom each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing left over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat.
Okay. Especially that last part. If you need more, take more. And if you need less, take less. Take what you need. And nobody was in trouble. The only people in trouble, the next verses, you know what they are, were who? Those who took more than enough, theirs rotted and the stink rose to heaven. Now, since I was kind once, I'll be a little more biting. That's what you smell all around. That's what it is. It's the stink rising to heaven from the excess, from the more than enough, from the hoarding up, from the conspicuous consumption, which is not freeing. It has become our slavery. The manna paradigm was used in 2 Corinthians 8:13 to 15. Let's turn to it while we still have that in mind. We won't have a chance to do that as much as I'd like in an hour, but let's do it when it's clear. 2 Corinthians 8:13 to 15. That's page 1008. I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, so that their abundance may supply your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Paul makes the reference that understanding of manna is a helpful understanding for how we live within the communion of saints, for how we share. So he takes that not only as a historic incident, but as one of the ways in which we view how much we need and what we do with that which might be more than we need. Lest you think that that's an isolated situation and only a New Testament application of it, turn to Exodus 20:25. Nope, that's not right. I have the wrong Exodus. Well, if somebody can find, I'll read it. I have the, I'm sorry, wrote the wrong. The reference I want is, if you advance money to any poor man among my people, you shall not act like a money lender. You must not exact interest in advance from him. Does anybody see, do I have the wrong chapter? 22:25. Thank you. 22:25. If you lend money to any of my people. All right. Let me just take the whole matter of usury or the interest charged on a loan, not only biblically, but in the history of the church. I think we may get back to discussions within the church and at Holden on whether or not to charge interest on loans. That'd be an interesting thing to come around. That one's kind of settled in our minds, right? Biblically, this is not the only place where this is mentioned. There is an assumption in the Old Testament that if it would happen one year, how inconceivable to think that not only did God supply all your need, but more than you needed so that you had extra. If that happens, it's inconceivable to think that someone who was not blessed as well as you, and for whom you might help out by lending, that you'd make money off the fact that you were blessed and he wasn't. It just run that up at your local savings and loan. Try that sometime. All I'm saying is, within the history of the church, we did not always have the assumption that the church's investment policy should be the highest rate of interest. I've asked them how they make their decision, and the church, like any other bank or any other institution, first of all, safety and the highest interest rate. A friend of mine who was a priest in Chicago took those two reasons, because the Archdiocese of Chicago uses the same two reasons as the American Lutheran Church, went into the bishop and said, if those are the only two, I recommend that we invest in the local mafia. It was the safest and the highest interest rate. And the bishop was upset and said, well, that would be immoral. He said, oh, if morality enters, can we look again at our portfolio? Right? Absolutely right. We rip off Namibians. They get 1/20th of what a white man would get. And the church invests in American Metal Climax and Newmont Mining. I know they do. I questioned it at the seminary when I was on the Board of Regents. If morality enters our investments, now you have something else. All I'm saying is, biblically, I wouldn't charge you interest if I had more than enough and you needed something. These were part of the Nicaea, Council of Nicaea. At Nicaea, it said, you all can do it. You really are not that religious anyway, but priests should not charge interest. I'd be insulted if I were you. Carthage. Carthage objected to even the idea of laypersons doing it. You got into the act. They thought maybe you wanted to be fully biblically too. Luther essentially in his writings challenged and sometimes condemned the idea of charging interest. Ezekiel 18:16 had high praise for the one who gives bread to the hungry and clothes to those who have none, who never lends either at discount or at interest. Ezekiel 18:16. I hope it was right that time. My chapter was off to. It's somewhere around there, Bill. All right. Let's take Leviticus 25. The whole chapter. And again, I understand that trying to get behind some assumptions in 1 hour can mean that we're really flitting through. I hope you're interested enough that you go back to some of these and kind of test my premise at other times when you read. That's what's fun. And in the winter, we can do that here for 2 weeks, you know, when there's 60 people and we're snowed in. In the summer, we have to keep moving a little farther. Leviticus 25 is Jubilee year. Let me give you a little background for that. I'll give you personal background first. When the American Lutheran Church was formed in 1960, every pastor got in the mail a plastic ram's horn. I tried to blow the thing. I couldn't get a peep out of it. So I was just out of seminary. In order to look loyal, I put it up on my filing cabinet because it came with a wooden thing that you held it in. The printed thing from headquarters said that on a certain Sunday, we were to blow this and declare Jubilee year. And since I couldn't blow it, I never went and read what Jubilee year was. I cannot imagine what they would have done to me if I had declared Leviticus 25 in that suburban congregation in Washington, D.C. That's some of the most radical stuff, politically and economically, that you'll find anywhere. If you look through Leviticus 25, you'll find that on the 50th year, Sabbath is seventh year, and on the every seventh year, there were some things that were part of the culture at this time, like letting the land lie fallow every seventh year. That was also a kind of enough is enough. Maybe we do the same thing now with crop rotation, with not overplanting. Maybe one of the ways we would live that out is keep the hedgerows instead of getting that little bit more and then letting the wind blow some topsoil. looking for the longer term care of the earth instead of the maximum profits. I don't know how, I'm not sure that land fallow every seventh year is the best way, but for them it was care of the earth. But on the 50th year, 7 times 7, right, 49th and Jubilee year, there were three other things, and if you glance through, you'll get the hints of what they are. Like in verse 8, you shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years. Send abroad a loud trumpet. That's what we were supposed to do with that ram's horn. Jubilee year 13. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. If you sell to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. According to the number of years after Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor. According to the number of years for crops, he shall sell to you, etc. 25, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, next of kin shall come and redeem. If a man has no one to redeem it, he himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, etc. If you read it, you'll find in the chapter 4 aspects of Jubilee. The land lies fallow. That happens every 7 years, so it happens again on 7 times 7. But there's three other things. Debts are canceled. Apparently the assumption that if you let that thing go on and on of debts and debtors, that finally more and more will accumulate into the hands of very few, and the rich will get richer and the poor get poorer, so every 50 years just level the thing and start over again. If land has had to be sold, and so a family had to give up their land, 50 years, return it to the previous owner. Don't let anybody amass more and more land. Level it out. And then prisoners are released. Okay, those are the four things. Land lie fallow. That's not controversial where you live, probably. Although I said that in Arapahoe, Nebraska, and the rest of the afternoon was on chemical farming and organic farming and land lie fallow. Here were young farmers in their 20s, and their grandpas are on one side with natural farming, and the middle class, the middle age, 40, 50, the fathers were for high chemical. They had been talking about that in the parking lot for 3 years, but had never had permission to talk about it in church. So that afternoon, it was the greatest church conversation about care of the land, because all I had done was given them permission. So I stepped back, and they went at it for a whole afternoon. Those other three, no matter where you live, are going to be controversial. Cancel debts, return land to the previous owner, and let the prisoners go free. Jubilee year, I think, and by the way, Ralph Gehrke last summer was here and talked about attempts at social reform in the Old Testament. So a key one was Leviticus 25. Apparently, they found a good lawyer. And you did something on the 48th year to kind of set all that aside, and you took it back on the 50th year or something. You weaseled out of the intent of this. The fact that there was some kind of social legislation did not mean they couldn't find income tax evaders and lots of other things. But I think the key thing is there was an assumption of enough is enough in this idea of Jubilee year. All right. If you get to the New Testament, and I want to leave time for your discussion too. If you get to the New Testament, I think you've got these same strains. We saw where Paul picked up on the manna idea. Let's see, if you've got some different translations, turn to Philippians 4:4. And read, verses 4 and 5. Would someone read that?
Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let all men know your forbearance. The Lord is at hand.
What do some of the rest of you have for verse 5?
Let your moderation be known unto all men.
All right. Moderation, forbearance. Anybody have another word from another translation?
Let your tolerance be evident to everyone.
Tolerance be evident, okay?
Show a gentle attitude.
Gentle attitude, okay? That may be trying to get more at the Greek word. Epikasis. I had never liked this passage as a ALC Lutheran. Let your moderation be known unto all men. That's the way I memorized it. And I thought, oh my goodness, of all the people on the earth, I think I'm in the most moderate church I have ever seen. Even within Lutheranism, the LCA was supposed to be liberal and the Missouri conservative and the ALC was right in the middle. I wanted to be either hot or cold, and I thought I'm in this group that's moderate. If there's anything we didn't need was more encouragement to be moderate. Bishop Taylor, by the way, much of what we're trying to do today is well done in a little book called Enough is Enough by John V. Taylor. He is an Anglican bishop who wrote a 9-page mimeograph letter to the priests in his diocese about these issues, and it was so much where the struggles were that the student Christian movement of England asked him to expand it into studies for them for the whole year. And then it became into a paperback book published by some little publishing company, and lo and behold, a bishop had an underground bestseller. Now that, the spirit's still alive when that can happen. 80,000 books sold, mostly to college-age students in England, that a bishop had written. And the U.S. publication of that was done by Augsburg, our ALC publication house. His third chapter, A Theology of Enough, has some of this biblical material in more detail than we're doing today. But he says this word has the picture of fitting in or toning in. Let your moderation be known unto all men would really be, can you picture if in the world today, in the midst of what Time magazine describes, that if the image of Christians in America, unlike the image of the ugly American, were those people who fit in environmentally instead of thinking that that Old Testament have dominion over meant do anything you want with the world. Ask Rudy Edmond, who wrote the book about taking care of the earth. He wrote to Old Testament professors all over and has come to the point that in the Old Testament means really caress tenderly. Now that's very different if that's the context of have dominion over the earth. If we fit in better environmentally, and if we fit in better as far as the total number of people in the world, and our fair share of the world's resources. That's why there are a lot of people saying we can't afford another United States. And if you don't know it, there's more and more saying we're not sure we can afford the one we've got. I don't know if you like to hear that or not, but ask Paul Wee and others who are on faculty who travel a lot, and we are simply not thought of anymore as the saviors. We're thought more and more as the problem. Why? I just heard a new statistic, 5.4% or something. I used to say 6% of the world's population, but we're under 6% of the world's population, and we eat a third of all the food. And we use somewhere around 45% of all of its resources. And it isn't only to produce things to then be unselfishly selling to others. It's a consumer lifestyle that is becoming part of the world's problem. We use 4 times the energy of Japan per capita, and they're civilized, so much of what we do is waste. And if that doesn't convince you, we use over twice what Swedes use. Now they certainly are civilized, right? They're all Lutherans. Part of our lifestyle is not that we are comfortable, not that we want enough. Part of it is more than enough. I think if we gave a witness of let your moderation, let your fitting in or toning in be known to all men, that would be part of the Christian witness today. I started by saying in every age, there are some issues which shape our mission questions. I think some of the mission questions have to do with just those kinds of things. There are 2 ways to get enough. One is to continue to accumulate more and more and more, and the other is to desire less. And I just think not only is it more biblical, but it's much less hassle if it's possible for you to take that second route. In either case, you are full. In either case, you have enough. And I'd like the rest of the hour to respond not only to some of the biblical material, but what that might mean for us. I don't think anybody is going to tell you what's enough. I don't think enough of us have tried to determine it for ourselves. And I think that's a good first step. I have on some of the retreat materials a list of 10 things. Pick any ones you want. I say room temperature inside in January. Then, thing, number of cups of coffee a day, number of vacation days a year, annual salary, things that you can put an amount on. Then the first column is, at what point would I say I am deprived? At what number is less than enough? And people can do that very quickly. Unless I make $18,000 a year, I don't have enough. I don't get it. Unless the room temperature is 68, I'm cold. All right. The second column is, at what point is it more than enough, more than I need, too many? And that's harder for people to do because we don't do that very often. But there is a point at every one of those where that's just more coffee than I can take. I mean, all right. There is a great freedom in making that move. A friend of ours in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., said to his wife, they were 55 years old, said to his wife, how many of our friends who are now older than we, how many have said to us, when we have enough, we're going to retire? She said, oh, I guess all the people I know in their 60s. And he said, how many have done it? She said, none. He said, why? She said, I guess they never sat down to figure out what was enough, so they never knew when they had gotten there. He said, right, let's do it. And they sat down. They determined what was enough. I didn't determine. They determined what was enough, and lo and behold, they were within a year of that. Of all they needed in the way of security, insurance, medical coverage, house to live in, trips to see their five kids, okay? They were very close to that. The next year they retired, and he has had the greatest years of his life. He gave 80 acres to the inner city council of churches in D.C. for kids, and he raised Christmas trees on it. He helped the Lutherans get a retreat center, and for 2 years was the cook and did the carpentry work. He wrote his novel. Everybody has a book in him. Everybody. He had never had time to do that before. And it's been about 10 years ago, and he had enough. If he hadn't done that, he would have continued in real estate until a heart attack took him. He now knows that. All I'm saying is that's a really big step of freedom. Time magazine once came to Newport Place in Washington, D.C., where Mary and I live. If you don't know D.C., I'll give you just the briefest history so you know who lived on Newport Place. Way back, the white folks lived on M-N-O-P, and in between were little streets. Newport, Swan, Phelps, Riggs, and the black folks lived on the little ones. And it was a nice arrangement because from the back porch of the black folks' houses, they could walk through the backyard and into the kitchen and be the servants of the people in the big house on the other street. The tour guide will never tell you that. You have to live in D.C., and you'll picture, if you do it, you'll see the width of the house and everything else, the height of the house. You've got a constant dip between N, Newport, M, Phelps, R. We lived at the end of Newport. And Newport, if you haven't lived in the inner city, you've missed the great custom of one person who presides over the block. Small towns have it. It's the guy in front of the post office. You know who I mean? Nobody elected him. He's retired. He sits there all day long. Okay. We had one man who presided over Newport Place. His name was David Roberts, retired old black fella. And it was nice. If I left in the morning, I waved. And if I got back at 5, I knew I could say hello again. And he had stood there all day. I liked David. When Time magazine came to interview people, the editors of Time had given this assignment. Do you think the civil rights movement is making progress in America? Well, the reporter saw only one person that you could even conceive of interviewing, David. So he went up and said, sir, do you think the civil rights movement is making progress? And David straightened and said, I know it is. And the reporter got his pen out. Here was a man who knew. He said, how do you know? He said, I went to the doctor, and he told me I had hypertension, and that used to be a white man's disease. Sharp prophet saying, I've made it. I've moved into that which is the culture, and I now have a white man's disease called hypertension. All I'm saying is let the first steps be the steps of freedom from insatiable appetite. Don't misunderstand me. If I have a reputation, it's that here comes Schramm, and he's going to tell you to give up anything that's fun or fattening. I'm not saying that all of the changes that are going to come to us in the next 10 years are going to be fun. I think we're going to be stopped. And I think we're going to be stopped primarily because there's still a God of history. And I don't think all of the changes that are going to come are going to be voluntary. In fact, I think for most U.S. citizens, church members included, most of them are going to be involuntary. I'm saying, I think if we have a biblical way of seeing, we'll begin to take some first steps that are not impoverishing at all. They are a new understanding of enough, and a new understanding of the slavery of more than enough, of insatiable appetite. Can we talk about that for the other 15 minutes that we have?
Well, aside from being biblical, it just makes common sense not to accumulate a bunch of junk. You don't have to stick around driving it.
All right. Have you
really?
Experienced that yourself?
Yeah, we rented our house out this year to come here. And within 3 months, it had been cleaned out.
By the renter.
By the renter. we had two things left. And we find that really the two essential pieces of furniture you need anyway, that's a bed and a table. They didn't take the bed because it's too big to get out of the bedroom. And the table we loaned to someone to take care of it for us. And we never really did collect a lot of stuff anyway, but it's all gone and I really don't care. And I know darn well I'm not going to go back and collect a bunch of other stuff to take at this point.
If you,
it's not worth it. You can't move around. You can't be mobile. You've got to be stuck.
I don't know how you'd implement that. A friend of mine implemented it with deciding how many shirts he really wanted or needed, because beyond that, he found he was hanging them or cleaning them or storing them or moving them and not wearing them, so he came to a number, 4, 5, 6, what have you. And he still, once in a while, likes to get a new shirt as a gift. But when he does, he gives one of the others away because he decided what was enough. That second step is what we don't do. And then you really do find you're mothballing it or building another room on your house for it or something. At what point does it become a burden? I don't think we come to that very often.
One of the biggest businesses in our country right now are these new sheds that you can buy that look like barns.
Yeah.
Store your junk.
Yeah.
Huge business. You see it all over the landscape. It's
amazing. How about the garage sales where you get rid of them?
The garage sales have just about done in Goodwill Industries in many cities. Did you know that? It's a new phenomena, and the Goodwill doesn't get the stuff much anymore. And that's a kind of middle class old lawn party. I mean, it's an interesting phenomena. But yeah, and there's always somebody there the day before the garage sale. Did you ever notice that? Who has to go into the hospital the next day? So that's why she's coming early or he's coming. Always one of those in every city.
Right.
Yes.
I think a real psychological fear of many people, and this is voiced back in our church back home, is that this idea of sharing, of equality, of, you know, the less blessed, is the fear that, well, then those of us that want to work for it even enough are going to support all the folks that don't want to work. And how do you get around that?
What do you say?
I guess that my first reaction is I'm a little bit scared of that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To try and be practical, I say, well, obviously then it's a very complex question to search for the responsible way to do that. But people look around and say, well, who's doing it responsibly?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a hard time answering that sometimes. Very
mm-hmm.
few
organizations. In fairness to some of the passages in the Old Testament, those are usually within the community, within the house of Israel, so that part of the start of this is some kind of shared value system, some kind of support group of other people who share this. But I think the key thing is whether or not you are doing it because you find it to be freeing. Until you do, you're going to worry about getting took. You're going to worry about future financial security. Clarence Jordan preached a sermon, and it's on one of his tapes or his records. He says, he's reading in Sermon on the Mount, take no thought for the morrow. And there's a long pause, and I wasn't there, but I can imagine Clarence Jordan just looking everybody right in the eye and getting a little twinkle. And then there's, now, if you have not made the fundamental shift, don't pay any attention to what I just said. In fact, what I just said is very bad advice. If you're not in a new kingdom, then don't listen to that take no thought, no, get all the insurance you can afford. and stocks and bonds and a fence around your house and a gun to protect it. That's what security is. That's absurd security. Take no thought for the mark. Unless there's been a fundamental shift. Unless you're coming from a very different assumption. And until people are, we're talking about a new reality, and they ought to stand up to your sermons on the Sermon on the Mount and say, that's absolutely nonsense. It is, without the shift. And we keep assuming when we preach that the shift has taken place. And if it isn't, somebody ought to stand up.
You know. So you're saying that concern is a very secondary one.
I'm saying if you come with the assumptions behind that New Testament understanding of security, it's very secondary. But until we really are able to talk that through and find out just how much metanoia has happened within us, and that it's very human, and that we shouldn't make people just feel done in by the fact that they desire some security, because that's a natural kind of response. Gandhi, I just get upset all over the place. Gandhi said life insurance is the highest form of atheism. Now he's meddling. I got a wife and four kids. My policy's with Lutheran Brotherhood. You know.
Missouri Synod used to tell us that too.
There's other hands up. Yes.
You were talking about implementing this. I set out to do this a few years ago, simplifying our lifestyle, cutting down the expense of our living, because I didn't like working and I wanted to get out of it. And I thought it's really very possible. One of the things I did is I researched our diet and figured out all these non-nutritious things that we were spending money for, and figure out how many calories we needed to maintain an ideal. And I can feed our family very well on $1.50 a week. That's at the grocery store. That includes paper products and everything. And it's great. I work at casual basis. I try to do all kinds of things I also want to do.
Great.
One of the things that I found, though, is that do not read advertisements and do not watch commercials.
All right.
So they create a desire for things. And they're a messenger. That means
right.
So far.
Right. One of the things is, I think the present lifestyle in the United States, and it has lots of benefits. Some of the people who make the simple life, namely the rural, no indoor plumbing and all that, sound so romantic. I'd like to take them to some of our neighbors in West Virginia who are old and arthritic and walk a half a mile to a stream to bring back a bucket of water. I'd like to help those people get a pipe into their house with water. So don't think that I'm talking about some new fad. But one of the things I think that the present lifestyle in the United States does not do is ask us to be as creative as we're able to be, and we really are more fulfilled when we have to be more creative. There's more fun to being creative, and it's kind of taken that away from us. It's made us specialized. We're at the mercy of the repairman. We don't know how to fix anything when it does. I mean, we really are kind of ripped off by some of the things that the new lifestyle has brought. Other things. Yeah.
For the past several years, I felt quite self-righteous about how I didn't learn these things, and I was really forced to be quite frugal. This is the first year that I've been working. I began my profession, so a free paycheck they would tell me that they made them. And I found all of a sudden that apparently I wasn't convinced that the frugal life was the best, because when I found the money that went, it was that. And now, when I was a student, if I had to make a move, I could get everything into one car and move. And before I came to Holden, I had to move out of the place to pick up loads and furniture and all of that. And I'm just beginning to see that the amount of money we have doesn't seem to. You have to make a commitment of some sort, regardless of the amount of money you have. Even if you're a student, you have to make the commitment to a simple lifestyle. If you have the money, you have to make that commitment. What to do with the extra money is sort of the question now. I have questions about it.
Yeah.
And I think that some of us are forced into a simple lifestyle because of lack of money or resources. And yet, when those circumstances change, we become just as much a consumer as anybody else around us.
Have you ever seen the little magazine called The Other Side from Savannah, Ohio? Very, very refreshing. It's The most encouraging thing in the U.S. church scene for me are the radical evangelicals. That's Sojourners. You ever read Sojourners? It's people with a very deep biblical faith, often out of Mennonite, Quaker, Brethren. But because of that biblical faith, they are very radical on economic, social, and lifestyle issues, which I've always thought was consistent, but which you don't find very often. The Sojourners community is very close to where Mary and I lived in D.C., 7 blocks away. They live in some houses in D.C. But the other side is less presumptuous. Sojourners is sometimes presumptuous. The other side is very folksy. They had correspondence between two families, both of whom changed their lifestyle, both of whom wanted to arrive at what would be a fitting in moderation witness, and they decided on $8,000 a year for a family of four in the United States. They heard from the United Nations that if we lived at that level right now, there could be a sustainable society throughout the whole world. I'm not sure any one of those numbers is helpful, but for them, they wanted to try it. One family had an awful time. They did everything that they had been trying to do before, but they cut out everything that was not absolutely essential from their budget, namely anything that was fun or entertainment, or they even cut out an extension phone. And one of the reasons they had it was the woman was arthritic or something, and the stairs had been a problem. In other words, they got down to where life was really tough. The other family had not had any assumptions that they had to keep that house and keep those jobs and keep two cars and live where the whole business. They had all kinds of new options, and they began living communally and changed everything. And they had more than enough money with the $8,000. What I'm saying is, I think lifestyle changes will feel like impoverishment unless you have some new assumptions and maybe have some more radical lifestyle changes than just diet and how many shirts you have. And I don't know how many people are able or willing to make those kinds of shifts, but I think some are beginning to make them. One of the churches in Renton, Washington, Lutheran Church in the suburbs, has said that everybody is looking at it. I mean, you can move to the country and change your lifestyle. Well, how many people have that option? That the real task is to find out how you live a more free life in the suburbs, where most of those people want to stay. And so there's this, their program is called Progress is Downward Adjustment. And they're trying to figure out what their faith and their theology would say as to how you live in Renton, Washington. They're having a great time. I think if our community of faith is the place where we're talking about this, it can be a support base, and it can be fun. We were with that kind of group in D.C., and those were some of the best years of our life. I mean, we tried to do things corporately I don't know how many of you fast. I think it can be a helpful discipline, but for some people it's simply missing meals that day. Well, we tried to look at it another way. There was one evening a week when we had an extra hour and a half. Food preparation, consumption, and cleaning up afterwards is an hour and a half for somebody, isn't it? So we had an extra hour and a half, and then it was fun figuring out what we're going to do on Monday nights when we don't have to eat. One night we had a progressive non-dinner. It was great. We went to a house where we did not eat an appetizer. Sang a song and played a game and moved 4 blocks down where we did not eat a salad. It ended up at our house where we did not have dessert. It was fun. It's a little kooky, but that's all right, isn't it? I assume you know at Holden that you vote with your feet when the session for you is over, and it can be over any time you want. I will be glad to stay until 10 o'clock, but when the bell rings for coffee hour, that ends everything at Holden. I've not been able to change that as the director, so I've quit trying. The coffee hour is more important, I think, than Vespers. But anyway, we have till 10, but if some of you want to go ahead. Huh?
Now, one of the things that troubles me is breaking the cycle. You know, we're locked into our value system, and I don't think the church will ever take the leadership until the majority of the people have made the shift. There's not a willingness to take that first step, that messy step within the professional church, because it is risky and because it is not the viewpoint of the majority of the congregation. So you therefore see the church continually to this day has this viewpoint of bigger is better. We've got to have more property, we've got to have more facilities in order to carry out our mission in today's world. And I don't see the cycle breaking.
Well, you're getting a lot of heads nodding. Do you want to speak to that? Not just vote on whether you're pessimistic or optimistic, but can we break through and say, what can you do if you feel this way and you're part of a church? And there were
I think what Merton says about peace, fighting for peace seems ridiculous. That's what most of the wars are about, fighting for peace. But if one person has peace, then at least there's some peace in the world. And I think if two people in a congregation decide to make the change is being made. And next year, maybe they'll be three. And I think it's going to take a lot of courage. One of the things that I picked up here this winter through John and through other reading is that Jesus never asks us to give up anything that doesn't enslave us. And that's a good way to start. What are we a slave to? And start there by giving that up. Sure, it's hard. I love TV. But I'm not going to get one when we go back. Because I'm a slave to it. It makes me want all that crap here.
Yes.
I think that I agree with that gentleman down there that we are sort of locked into a system. And that's mainly because we haven't even started to ask the right questions. I recognize that this year I went to an Ohio District Convention for the first time. And we were, it seemed like on any little trivial item, there was great debate. And then one of the last items that came up was pay raises for the clergy. And the only rationale I heard behind that was, well, inflation's up so-and-so percent, so naturally we would raise the salary so-and-so. And naturally that went through unanimously. And there never was asked, the question, is that what we need? Or is what we have enough? It really startled me. And when I brought that up with some pastors, they said, what, are you trying to be some sort of martyr or something? Mm-hmm. Well, I got four kids, But I think it's important that the church start to ask the hard questions. And at this point, I haven't seen too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still wet behind the ears.
Yeah, Chuck?
I keep standing up as sort of a defender of the city. I think the idea of cutting back is the idea of developing a self-sufficient or a new kind of independence in the midst of the helter-skelter of the large metropolises of the nation, like the Philharmonic that escaped Seattle to get rid of that hassle back there. It really disturbs me. I wish that we could think in terms, or at least see the necessity of our interdependence as people. And starting from that point, develop a simpler lifestyle in the midst of community. And look at your suburb, not as a hassle, but as a potential for a greater community that makes beautiful living possible instead of the kind of secluded running away. It's almost an attempt to embrace what you have there with a new kind of an attitude. Make something better out of it.
Only regular journal, I think, on urban and suburban attempts at simplified lifestyle is from Worthington, Ohio, called Doing It. Most of the simple life material is more rural and not kind of assuming that we are becoming and are an urban nation and that we should try to do it where we're. I think one of the problems is one of the locking in that we have there is the automobile and the lack of public transportation or mass transit. That was an unfortunate decision, and we're still voting down mass transit. I don't know how long ago. It wasn't too long ago. Los Angeles voted it down again. But so that there are some givens that make it more difficult. But the simplest step, like carpooling, is not coming very fast. So. That's something you could start in your parish or with other people who share that kind of view. Other reactions or comments? I can't see you maybe if you're up in the balcony. Got anything else that you're...
The carpooling thing down the barrier finally happened from the gas.
Yeah.
That's obvious, but
all the advertising in the world didn't do anything until there was incredible inconvenience.
The church, it seems to me, Hans, that it at least in the Lutheran church, that a start is a strong commitment to the Word. I mean, that Lutherans will at least continue to listen if you say, let's see from the Word if there's something that speaks to the milieu of these kinds of crises, that's a starting place. We don't have a lot of outstanding examples from corporate, institutional, or church leaders. We have some. The bishop of the Roman Catholic bishop of Spokane is one. He goes farther on simple life than I do because his house is 40 degrees in the winter. I'm cold at 40 degrees. He sold the house that the bishop lived in and lives in a $4,000 house, and is good humored and refreshing and right on target. He says the simple life is not some new way for you to be tighter than a bark on the tree with your money. It's not a new reason for you to be stingy. It's so you can share with the poor, which he does. Now, for a bishop, his shoes are three sizes too big because they came in a clothing drive. He took them, so he wears three pairs of socks. I mean, he has some idiosyncrasies. He's going to be hard to follow. And I think we wish there were more bishops doing it, and I'm not sure there's going to be many bishops doing it. Most of them have trouble with being overweight, and their red vest and their pectoral cross sits on a large Milwaukee goiter or whatever Rich Kemmerer calls it. But I don't think we can say that's keeping me from being faithful. And maybe that's what Jack... We finally don't have to make history come out right, but we are called to be faithful. And I guess I think if it's a joyful... If we've chosen it, not because it feels like deprivation, but if it's new wine, the old wineskins will burst. We don't really have to spend a lot of time bursting them even. And I'm not sure we have to spend any time designing the new wineskins. I think we live out a new understanding of what it means, what the good life means. We are counterculture to the TV advertisements on what the good life is. Knowing you're going to get co-opted. This whole movement is already co-opted. There is machinery called simplicity. And Prudential says, we make things simple. The word simple is gone. They took it, Madison Avenue took it within 6 weeks. Just know that's going to happen, right? That's all right.
There's really nothing simple about it anyway. It takes an awful lot of work.
Yeah, it,
and it doesn't give you much time to feel sorry for yourself about what you don't have.
And keep it, I guess I've already said, keep it communal, keep it within the fellowship of faith, and keep the humor in it. G.K. Chesterton said there's more simplicity in eating caviar spontaneously than eating porridge out of principle. Just keep that one up there. Yeah, Bruce.
One of the moods that I've been, I guess primarily the church, because that's more where I've spent most of my time, is that more and more people are adjusting to the fact that sometime in the future we're going to drastically have to cut back, and that's almost a granted at this point. And so in the meantime, let's get all we can get, because the crunch is coming. There's not going to be any dinner, let's have an extra slice of bread for lunch. We'll be able to put up without the dinner, but let's not rush it.
Yeah. I'm saying in the roots from which we come, there's a very strong tradition of a people who were able to pray daily for bread. And I think we can do that again. We haven't had to do it when we owned the bakery. And we may learn to do that again, to pray daily for bread. But that's not been a real bad way to live. And there has been an exhilarating faith when those times came. So keep the faith. Thank you.